time for Yakety Science. Greetings, everyone, and welcome to Yakety Science, the Tulsa Science Show. We are the program that shines a bright but humorous light into all of the darkest recesses of Havers canals, Langerhans islets, Henley's loops, and Fallopio's tubes. We are the show that finds the spark in your speleology, the glitter in your glaciology, the flash in your fulminology, the ember in your embryology, the eerie green glow stick in your gastrology. Kids, stop swallowing those glow sticks. I am Brian Cross, Associate Professor of Biology at Tulsa Community College, and your humble host. First up, as always, my co-host, Matt Smith, Associate Professor of Chemistry at Tulsa Community College. Say hello to the nice people, Matt.
Hello, I'm happy to be here.
Matt, do you know what fulminology is?
I think it has something to do with lightning.
It does, yes, very good. Right, so flash in your fulminology, right?
I was very proud of that one, mostly because of video games. We'll use, like, Fulgora as like a lightning spell or a lightning plan or something
Fulgora.
Like that.
Fulgora?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right. What's going on, Matt?
Actually, I learned something new this week.
It was bound to happen eventually.
It was bound to happen eventually. Yeah, no. It's just a long-held misconception I've had that I didn't realize was wrong until I saw this discussion online.
You believe that chemistry was superior to biology, and now you realize
that is not the misconception I'm talking about. That is a correct statement. I will say. No, this has to do with the sun. Mm-hmm. So if we go outside and look at the sun, right, mm-hmm. You know that sunlight takes 8.3 something.
Let me stop you right there, Matt. If your big insight here is the Earth moves around the sun and that the sun is actually not moving through the sky, then I think our listeners are already aware.
I think they are already aware of that one. This is different still. Okay. So you know that sunlight takes 8.3 something minutes to get here.
I'm aware of that.
So when you look at the sun in the sky, is that literally where the sun is right now?
Well, it would be 8 minutes behind where it is,
Minutes behind or eight minutes forward? And it's actually not. That is literally where the sun is right now. Right. If we stopped time and pointed at the sun, we would be pointing at the sun, not just the image of the sun, but that is literally where the sun is right now in this moment in time.
Okay, convince me.
Isn't that shocking? Because you think, the sun is, the image we're seeing is 8 minutes behind. Mm-hmm. But we're the ones who move through the sun's light. Mm-hmm. The Earth is the one that's moving. So actually the light that we're seeing right now was, of course, emitted 8 minutes ago, mm-hmm. but not to where we were, to where we are. Mm-hmm. It was emitted in the direction of where the Earth was going to be because, of course, the light from the sun goes in all directions. Mm-hmm. So the photons we're seeing right now were emitted in the direction where the Earth is going to be, not where it was now.
Because we're moving into it.
Yes. So we are literally, so that image we see of the sun in the sky is literally where the sun is right now. Isn't that wild? I had this weird misconception. It was like that you had too.
I did.
We're thinking, oh yeah, so it's 8 minutes behind or 8 minutes forward or something.
Shows our astronomical ignorance.
Right.
We need an astronomer on the show.
We should find one.
All right. Well, excellent, Matt. Thank you for enlightening all of us. We plan to further enlighten everybody with the launch of our new book club, Ourobookos, a Yakety Science book club.
Ourobookos, that's a fun word.
Ourobookos. Ourobookos. And for our first book, we're going to take on John Green's Everything is Tuberculosis. And if you read it, you will discover that truly everything is tuberculosis. The answer to every question in life is tuberculosis. And so we're going to cover everything, right?
So we're going to cover everything. Tuberculosis. Yeah. Okay.
And then we won't have to do the podcast anymore because we'll have covered everything.
If everything is tuberculosis, then that makes the chemical nomenclature section on my next test really easy.
It does,
they can just say tuberculosis.
Tuberculosis.
What's this formula? Tuberculosis.
Yeah.
That sounds great.
It's a good argument. It makes your grading much easier, too.
Really, it does. Goodness, can you imagine making flashcards for your classes now? Now it's just every side of every card is just tuberculosis.
Tuberculosis, that's right.
I'm not sure this is actually what the book is about because I haven't really read it, but I'm going to. Going to do my homework.
It is about all of the tendrils of tuberculosis and its effect on history and culture and public health, obviously, throughout the ages. It is the most deadly disease. It's the one that's killed the most human beings of all the diseases we're aware of. It is a thorny problem. It's one that we can treat with antibiotics, but also one that, you know, is developing resistance, one that we have failed to treat through lack of effort, right? And we've let it fester, and it has evolved resistance, and it continues to be a really serious problem.
Well, I look forward to reading this very uplifting-sounding book.
Yeah, we're keeping up with our recent theme of being sunny and optimistic about the future. Anyway, so I think we'll probably do this over three episodes. We'll take maybe a third in each of the next three episodes. And if you'd like to read along with us, you can, of course, just listen to what we have to say about it. But you can also read along with us. Send your comments in. Send your questions in. We'd love to have some listener questions to guide our conversation. So
I'm excited.
Excellent.
Eirenikos prosphilos eleluth.
Up first, we need to present our new sound science puzzler. In this segment of the show, I will challenge you to identify a science-related sound. It could be the sounds made by an animal, physical phenomenon, or it could be something that is associated with science in some other way. Here is your new sound science puzzler. That's it. What is that sound? We went local for this one. So it is a sound of spring that you might hear around Tulsa. It is not the sound of Matt running his finger over a comb. At the end of this episode, in the penultimate portion, just prior to the pithy pronouncements, we will reveal the answer. If you are a proper person, you will refrain from prematurely purloining the answer, and you will persevere through the rest of the program. Up next, we have the headlines. In this segment of the show, we trawl through, or perhaps troll through, the sciencey headlines that have struck our fancy since the last episode of Yakety Science. Up first, we have bad news from Antarctica. Matt, think back to the last time you were drilling through a kilometer-thick slab of Antarctic ice.
All right, I'm there, okay. I got it.
What most worried you about that endeavor?
Oh, it was definitely rabid penguins.
Matt, you're showing your biological ignorance again. Birds do not get rabies. No need to worry about that.
They don't? Wait, penguins are birds?
Anyway, the greatest non-penguin source of anxiety for you would probably be losing something down the borehole. You drop your bow tie down that hole, and you are not getting it back. And that is exactly what happened to scientists during a recent effort to understand the Thwaites Glacier.
Wait a second. What's that?
The Thwaites Glacier is the most important glacier in Antarctica and the most troublesome. It sits on the western side of the continent where the topography is more conducive to melting and to loss of the ice sheet. And its melting has been accelerating. It is threatening to drop a whole lot of water into the oceans and boost sea level rise significantly.
How the nerve of some glaciers. I won't stand for this. I refuse to be threatened by glaciers.
I'm not sure you have much choice, Matt. Ice is out of control and threatening everyone everywhere. And in this case, the threat takes the form of about 3 meters of sea level rise over the coming centuries. Warm water beneath the glacier, about 85 feet at the side of the borehole, is about 85 feet of water that's underneath the ice that's kind of sliding off the continent. That's lapping at the underside of the ice and accelerating the flow, melting the ice.
Okay, so I guess they want to understand, like, the dynamics of this process and figure out how quickly the sea level rise will happen?
Yeah, that's right. The process appears to be unstoppable. Once it starts, the topography makes it really impossible to stop.
So it's like a positive reinforcement loop.
Yeah, so it just once it gets going, there's an amplification of it. And the topography there is actually below sea level. So the land that the ice was sitting on originally was below sea level. And so it leads to this dynamic where it's going to continue. But the rate matters a lot. And so you need to really understand the details of that process, and you need to understand how fast it's going to happen. So they were trying to install instruments underneath the ice in that liquid zone, right, so that they could get ongoing data over the next few years so that they could get a real-time sort of picture of what's happening there.
Right. I remember I was there. I lost my bow tie along with these instruments.
Oh, did you? Okay, excellent. You were one of the 10 scientists who was down there.
Oh, I didn't want to say
I
that.
I thought they were British or South Korean. Which well, are you?
What can I say? Don't ask me to do an accent. I'm terrible at accents.
You've been hiding your British accent all this time. All right.
Okay, so, but they lost their instruments?
Yes, big whoops. They opened up the hole. They used jets of, this is really cool, jets of hot water to bore the hole. And then
drilling with water.
And then they lowered down a limited set of instruments to get some preliminary measurements. They got that. They pulled it back up. And then as they were putting the full set of instruments down, which had this big metal chain on the bottom of it that was supposed to kind of hold everything in place over the long term. So they lowered that down. They got about 3/4 of the way and then discovered that it was kind of piling up there at that point. So,
oh, dear.
So something shifted to block it or it just froze in place down there because it only stays open for a little while before it seals back up.
So you're saying the water refroze?
Yeah, so refroze around it. Or the glacier's moving and they can hear kind of cracking and rumbling. So it could have shifted and kind of pinched it. So they're not really sure, but it was piling up there. So and they couldn't reset. They didn't have time to try again and to get this
goodness
freed up.
So can they use the data just at 3/4 the elevation they thought they were getting down to, or
well, they are
entirely lost?
Yeah, they are getting some data from that. They got the preliminary data from underneath, right where the instruments went all the way down. They've had other data that they're getting from flying over and using instruments to look at the topography and the stuff that they were lowering down into fissures that develop in the ice sheet. But they didn't get what they want, which was something sitting underneath the ice that could then give them, you know, this ongoing picture of what's happening with the process of melting. So hopefully they'll try again and we'll get that data. It's important, right? It's the future of Miami and the Netherlands.
That's true. Right? Yeah.
Depend on how fast.
Many coastal societies really want to know what this is going to be.
That's where most of us live. So, all right.
All right. Well, next up, I'm sorry, but we got bad news about your boy Helium. It sabotaged the Artemis II launch.
I know. I heard. I can't help but think that it must be the influence of that most nefarious of all elements, hydrogen. It all began with hydrogen leaks in any event, I think. Is that right?
Yeah. So are they launching Artemis II in April now?
That's the plan, I think, if nothing else goes wrong. Keep your eye on hydrogen. You never know what it's going to do next.
Well, yeah, but like they've also made more radical changes to the program.
Yeah, I think they've kind of revamped it, and they are delaying things, but also kind of speeding things up at the same time. So Artemis II, hopefully, fingers crossed, launches this year in April probably, and it carries astronauts around the moon. Artemis III will launch in 2027 according to the new plan, but it won't go to the moon, right? Originally Artemis III was supposed to be the one that landed on the moon, but Artemis III now is going to launch in 2027, stay in low Earth orbit, and then they're going to test, you know, spacesuits and rendezvousing with the lunar lander, the lunar module, docking with that. So they're going to test some systems that are brand new. You know, there are all these things that they've contracted with the SpaceX and Blue Origin, you know, to, you know, the landing pieces. So they're going to test all of that. And then Artemis 4 in 2028 is supposed to be the one now that will go actually to the moon and land on the surface.
Okay, so that's like delaying everything. You said also speeding up.
Yeah, so I mean, actually, some of that is sped up. I think Artemis 3, then, under that timeline, is coming more quickly. It's just not going to the moon. So they're trying to speed up the pace, what they call the cadence of the mission. So they want shorter intervals in between launches, you know, getting it down from about 3 years, right? Artemis 1 was 3 years ago, and now we're doing Artemis 2, getting it down to like 10 months.
Okay, so more opportunities for SpaceX rockets to explode. Wait, are they using SpaceX rockets?
No, the SLS is not SpaceX, but then the lunar stuff is going to be for SpaceX and then the Blue Origin. So, you know, speeding things up always makes people nervous, but they say that they can do this safely. They're going to standardize the SLS. I'm not sure why the SLS wasn't standardized already, but standardize the SLS so it's easier to manufacture, and they don't have to fiddle as much with hydrogen leaks and helium flow problems and so on. I think they're also going to expand the NASA workforce. This seems to be one of the few areas where they're actually expanding a bit. And so that hopefully will speed things up as well, too. By the way, do you know what helium is doing for us here?
I was hoping you were going to get back to that because, you know, helium, it's bad. Helium sabotaged this, but what was it about helium that was messing it up?
It all started with hydrogen. Helium is used in the tanks to maintain pressure. So, like, as the tanks empty of the rocket fuel, they have to maintain pressure in there. They don't want... they want the liquid hydrogen to stay hydrogen, and they need the constant pressure in order
to
get the fuel.
Right. So as it empties, it doesn't
tanks.
All vaporize.
They feed in helium in order to make that work. So you get a nice smooth flow of the fuel to the rockets.
And so all the astronauts can have a nice squeaky voices.
That's
too.
Right. Well, hopefully it's not leaking into the crew compartment, but we'll know. We'll hear it in their voices.
Yeah,
if,
that's right.
If it is leaking in. All right. Well, we'll report back on that Artemis 2 launch if it actually happens in April. All right. Next up, Matt, we have a true profile in courage. A new study published this past December in Med, a Cell Press journal. I'm not sure why we have to say it that way. Med, a Cell Press journal, reports on experimental trials involving 27 courageous male volunteers, true heroes. The Dauntless 27, some are calling them. Verily, I tell you, Matt, they need not count their manhood cheap when tales of bravery are told. Tales of their grandfather storming the beaches of Normandy. Tales of intrepid astronauts risking all to make a giant leap for mankind. Tales of valiant firefighters charging into buildings engulfed in flames.
My goodness. Pray tell, what did they volunteer for?
Well, that's a bit awkward. Can't believe you asked that. But without any doubt, they are courageous.
Well, but you have to tell us how they were courageous. I can't help but, you know, think we're going to get emails. I mean, people want to know. You can't bring it up and then not talk about it.
Isn't it enough to know that lives will be saved? Undoubtedly, many, many lives will be saved.
Okay, but how?
Fine. They agreed to try butt breathing. Are you happy now?
I'm sorry. Butt breathing?
Yes, they are on the cutting edge of discovering whether humans can breathe through their butts.
Well, that's an ignoble line of study, isn't it? How are they accomplishing this? Insertion of something? What's going on here? How are they
Matt,
breathing? Is this like a butt snorkel?
Matt, why must you be so vulgar? Yes, it involved elaborate enemas with 1.5 liters of something called perfluorodecalin for 60 minutes. It's called enteral ventilation. Right? Not pulmonary ventilation, but enteral ventilation, a.k.a. butt breathing. Entero refers to the intestines.
Okay, so the fluid, the perfluorodecalin, carries oxygen, I assume?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay, and the patient absorbs it through their digestive tract then?
That's it, exactly. There is an interesting corollary here with the physiology of dragonflies, which have gills tucked up inside their posterior, so butt breathing. It's not just for odonates anymore.
You know, I have always wanted to be a dragonfly.
Have you? Right. Well, good start.
So why would
Phase two of the study, Matt, you can volunteer.
Maybe I will. Maybe I will. And I'll join those ranks of brave volunteers. Really, why would someone want to do this?
Well, I mean, it has to do with a really serious thing, which is people in respiratory distress. With inflamed lung tissue, the ventilation of the lungs doesn't work as well. You want to give the lungs more of a rest. And so maybe you could do this as an alternate way, temporarily alternate way of helping to
oxygenate
the blood. So as a stopgap
while you can keep them alive for surgery. Okay. Yeah. Well, perhaps we should observe a moment of silence for the bloated.
Yes, definitely. I'll let listeners do that on their own time. Okay. By the way, the diagrams here are just great if you'd like to take a look at them.
Oh my gosh, you're right. Look at that.
We will put that on the Instagram, definitely. All right.
I like how it shows how far into the GI tract they are at each interval here.
I know. They gradually ramp up to 1.5 liters. So
yes.
You get there, and then they have to hold it in for an hour, and then there's a really great diagram of somebody sitting on a toilet. <It's
there. laughs> Oh my gosh, you're right, there is.
In a science journal, there is a picture. That picture is in a science journal. All right. I'm sorry, we're children. We're toddlers. All right. You have to let us know how the phase two trials go. All right. Next up, we have The Sex Lives of Our Ancient Ancestors.
Ooh.
A study published in the most recent issue of Science proposes an interesting explanation for the distribution of Neanderthal DNA in our genomes.
I'm all ears. I'm ready for this.
Recall that humans have 22 pairs of autosomes, aka regular chromosomes.
Okay, thanks.
And one pair of sex chromosomes, XX for females, XY for males.
Okay, didn't actually know some of those words, but I'm okay, continue.
Okay, thank you for your honesty, Matt. anyway, when we look at the genome, at least for those not from sub-Saharan Africa, around 2% on average of our DNA appears to be Neanderthal in origin. And this happened because, of course, modern humans are migrating into areas where Neanderthals were already established across Eurasia, and then there's this mixing that is happening, and that's why we get modern human DNA in Neanderthals and Neanderthal DNA in humans is because of that mixing that occurred. You don't see it in modern humans in sub-Saharan Africa because they weren't part of the populations that mixed in Eurasia. So, interesting side note. So we look at this DNA, we have Neanderthal DNA in our genomes, and you can, you know, if you do one of those things like, what are they like?
What, a 23andMe?
Yeah, 23andMe.
Oh yeah, sell my data to the government.
Ancestry.com, you can get the, you can get a profile of your DNA and your origins, right?
And then the FBI can have it.
And they will give you a number for Neanderthal DNA, right? So how much Neanderthal DNA do you have? Generally, it's about 2%. But it is a lot more in some chromosomes than others. And one of the places where you don't have a lot of that Neanderthal DNA is the X chromosome. So you have about five times as much in the autosomes, again, the regular chromosomes, than you do on the X chromosome.
Okay, but what about the Y chromosome? I got one of those.
Well, the Y chromosome doesn't give you as much to work with because it's very small. It's a tiny, puny little chromosome.
How dare you?
It really just carries the, I have one too, it just carries the testes determining factor, which makes you a male, right? So when you think about it, the Y chromosome really can't carry that many important genes because females don't have it. Right, females have two X's, they don't have a Y. So if there were an essential gene for making hemoglobin or something, then females would lack it and that would be a problem, wouldn't it? So you can't really have essential stuff on the Y chromosome. But the X chromosome is big, like the autosomes. It has lots of stuff on it and lots of DNA to be analyzed. And we just don't see the Neanderthal DNA there that we see in other parts of the genome.
Okay, so how does this relate to my Neanderthal daddy?
I'm going to let that one go. There are two hypotheses for this. One, selection against the Neanderthal genes on the X chromosome. So they were preferentially eliminated because there was some disadvantage to them. They didn't work well with the other, you know, modern human genes that were there. Or two, biased mating in which Neanderthal males mate with females that are anatomically human. AMH is how we abbreviate that, anatomically modern human. So I will say AMH from here on out.
I'm not going to understand AMH or anatomically modern humans.
You're not.
Any better than the others.
You are an anatomically modern human, right?
Thank you. I am modern. Yes. That's great.
Most of you anyway. There's a little bit of...
2% apparently.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. Well, it's certainly not affecting me anatomically, I tell you that.
So we have Neanderthal males mating with human females.
Okay. Well, look, I mean, as a nerd, I can probably attest to the plausibility of the latter hypothesis. I mean, think of all the movies you see where you have all the beautiful cheerleaders always go for these like Neanderthal alpha beta males. Yeah. My bow tie and I are mystified.
Yes, mystifying. Anyway, we didn't really have any way to differentiate between hypothesis one and hypothesis two. But in this recent research, they have been able to test these hypotheses indirectly by looking at older Neanderthal DNA and human, anatomically modern humans, AMH, DNA found in their genome. So they went back to look at Neanderthal specimens. And oddly enough, when you look at the DNA, you see an excess of the human DNA in the X chromosome of Neanderthals, right? So kind of the reverse of the pattern.
Okay, so that does support the hypothesis earlier about, you know, modern females going for Neanderthal males.
Right, yeah.
So even back then.
So, yeah. So this seems to, there were kind of two sub-hypotheses. Like one is that you just had biased migration where females migrated into Neanderthal areas and then had mates, or something related to mate choice where preferentially Neanderthal males were mating with human females. So, and that's the most likely explanation, they conclude, from the population genetic data that they have. That's the most likely explanation for both patterns, right? The deficiency of Neanderthal DNA in the X chromosome of modern human females, and an excess of human DNA in those Neanderthal X chromosomes.
Okay, so it really points that your great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandmother was getting freaky.
That's right.
That's what we learn.
Yes, yeah. Right, or Neanderthal males were coming in, killing off all the modern human males.
Wow, buddy, jeez, okay.
Which is something that happens,
could be.
Honestly.
I like my version better.
You like, yes, so that's, there you go, right. Choose your version, whichever is least disturbing to you. Well, that's it for the headlines. Up next, we have Matt's Chemical Minute.
Totally natural thing in it. It's totally natural thing in it. It's totally natural thing in it. It's.
Matt's Chemical Minute is a segment lasting 5 to 7 indeterminate units of time. Matt is going to tell us about an element, a compound, or some other chemical entity, it'll be an element, that we should care about. He will then give this entity a rating of 1 to 5 stars. I will listen and then potentially argue with Matt about his rating. Today, Matt takes up chlorine, the most bleacherific of all elements. I just made up that word. Atomic number 17. Take it away, Matt.
Thank you. All right. So most chlorine on the Earth is actually in the oceans. 97% of all water on Earth is in the oceans.
Right.
And of that in the oceans, salinity is about 3.5 grams per liter. That's of all dissolved salts.
Mm-hmm.
Of that, 85% of it is sodium chloride. There's also like magnesium, calcium, sulfate ions,
so can you give
bicarbonate ions.
Can you give me an exact number of chlorine ions?
That means there's 3.1 times 10 to the 13th
tons
of sodium chloride in the oceans.
All right.
It was first isolated in 1774, but not actually identified as an element. This was done by Swedish chemist Carl Wilhelm Scheele. He's given credit for it anyways, which I think is polite, even though he didn't actually say, well, this is an element, this is chlorine. No, what he made was what he called dephlogisticated muriatic acid air. If there was a term even worse than phlogisticated or dephlogisticated, dephlogisticated muriatic acid air, it just takes the cake. So dephlogisticated would be combusted.
Yeah.
Muriatic acid air means it's hydrochloric acid fumes.
Right.
Even hydrochloric acid is called muriatic acid because muriatic means briny or salty.
Okay.
So it's the salty acid, apparently. That's what it is. In 1810, it was finally isolated and identified as an element by Sir Humphrey Davy, who did a lot of isolating and naming things. He chose to name it chlorine from the word chloros, which means yellow-green. If you're not thinking about sodium chloride, you're probably thinking about bleach, water treatment, disinfection, and bleaching. Bleach is sodium hypochlorite. It's a very useful oxidizing agent.
Mm-hmm.
If you ever wondered, how does bleach remove color from things? It is actually chemically changing the dye compounds, the molecules
right.
that give it that color. They're usually what we call conjugated pi systems, meaning that they have alternating.
Like blueberry and boysenberry?
Yeah, all those pies. Yeah,
yeah.
Pi, we mean like pi bonding, like double bond, single bond. Those kind of alternating
the other
features.
Pie.
Yeah, the other types of pies.
This is related to like SPF orbitals and that sort of thing.
Exactly, yes. Okay. And sigma and pi bonding. Yeah, they're breaking or altering those conjugated pi systems, and therefore the interaction with visible light is lost. So yeah, you're chemically breaking down those colorful molecules until they can't do anything.
And it's so reactive because it's a halogen, right?
So halogens are, of course, very reactive, and especially in their elemental states. So yeah, bleach is able to give off elemental chlorine. So let's talk about nice things before we get into the not nice things.
Okay.
Chlorine, absolutely necessary for all forms of life.
Okay.
Absolutely. As monatomic chloride ions.
Right.
They're there to maintain homeostasis, regulation of osmotic pressure, electrolyte balance, and of course, you can't forget making that good old stomach acid, hydrochloric acid.
That's true.
It's very important. Which, funny misconception, hydrochloric acid is not actually what digests your food. No, it's your digestive enzymes
right.
who prefer a nice acidic environment.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So pepsin. You're also at the same time producing pepsin. Yeah.
Yeah. Pepsin is your digestive enzyme.
Doesn't it unfold the protein so that then the pepsin can act on it?
Yes. So pepsinogen is the deactivated form, but when it's in the presence of an acid, it is activated and unfolded into pepsin.
Right.
That's right.
But I think the hydrochloric acid is also unfolding the proteins, isn't it? It's kind of unfolding helping, the three-dimensional structure.
Yes,
of the
but you wouldn't say it's like that's what's doing most of the.
Yeah, it's not breaking the bonds between the amino acids.
No, what it's doing is it's protonating certain things, and that makes them kind of change their shape a little bit. Mm-hmm. All right, time to get to the dark side of chlorine then. Ooh. Dark side of chlorine is, of course, as a weapon in World War I. This is developed by Fritz Haber, the father of chemical warfare.
He's also the father of chemical fertilizers as well, too. So
he is. Isn't that wild?
It's wild. About half of the human population is alive today because of fertilizers and increased agricultural
productivity. And some portion of the human population is also dead because of him.
That's right.
So, I mean, goodness.
He's a complicated character.
You take some and you lose some. Yeah,
like chlorine, he's a complicated character.
He's very complicated, yeah. It was first used in, 1915 in the Second Battle of the Ypres in France. And, yeah, as you mentioned, this is the same Fritz Haber who gave us the Haber process to make ammonia.
Yeah.
Very important. He actually was awarded the 1918 Nobel Prize for that thing. So yes, he invents the Haber process before World War I, goes to World War, commits war crimes, and then receives the Nobel Prize for the Haber process afterwards.
Right, because he not only developed chemical weapons, he deployed them.
He deployed them.
He was the commander
yes.
of the first
now,
unit.
Now, technically, he did not actually violate the Hague Convention.
Because it didn't exist yet.
No, the Hague Convention was in 1899.
Oh, was it?
Was the one that specifically prohibited deploying asphyxiating gases from projectiles.
Oh.
So he couldn't...
He opened up tanks and let it blow on the wind,
yes.
right?
So technically used an asphyxiating gas in warfare, but did not deploy it with shells. Of course, the horrible success of chlorine as an asphyxiating agent during that did, lead to even more horrific developments. Phosgene and mustard gas. Mm-hmm. Mustard gas actually was fired from shells.
Yeah.
Yet mustard gas is not actually a gas. So again, he gets off on a technicality, did not actually violate the Hague Convention. Yeah. All right, that's enough. That's enough of the dark side of chlorine.
Are we coming up on a rating?
In a moment. We have one victory story to tell about chlorine, and that is the story of the Montreal Protocol and CFCs. Mm-hmm. So CFCs, as you know, are called chlorofluorocarbons because they contain chlorine.
And fluorine.
And carbon.
Yes.
Yes, they are. Yeah. The most
it's funny
common.
How that nomenclature
I love the
works.
Nomenclature. It works out fine. The most common is dichlorodifluoromethane, so it's CF2Cl2.
Used in refrigerants.
That's right, yeah. Unfortunately, when something like this gets into the atmosphere, exposed to sunlight, and it undergoes a fun little thing called photolytic homolysis, which produces radicals. Radicals then react with the ozone, turning it into plain Jane oxygen. Which, of course, ozone is important, right?
Right, because it blocks the UV light.
Yeah, and we need to not be exposed to UV light. But back in 1987, countries from all over the world signed the Montreal Protocol, which regulated the use of CFCs and is a success story. It's actually leading to an ongoing recovery of our ozone layers.
Huzzah.
That is it for chlorine.
All right, so you have a rating now.
I do have a rating. Yes, very important for the body, but all those chemical weapons, I'm not a fan. I think chlorine's only going to get a 2-star rating from me.
2-star. Yeah, I was going to go 2 stars, but now that you've gone 2 stars, I can't. I'll go 3 stars. I think it is a very mixed element. It is really important to osmotic balance and the function of muscles and neurons and a whole bunch of stuff.
All those
digestion.
Things. Yes. All right, so 2.5 stars for chlorine.
Excellent. 2.5 stars. And next up, we have our next noble gas, I think.
That's right. We do. Argon. The dinosaurs were here, but now they are gone.
Excellent. All right. No comment. And that brings us to Yakety Science Ruins the Movies. In this segment, we will take on a Hollywood blockbuster and pedantically explain how they got the science so incredibly wrong. Yes, we are those know-it-all people that you never want to take to the movies. We just can't enjoy ourselves. We want to share that lack of joy with you.
All right, so the movie we're going to ruin this time. Are you ready for it?
Of course you're ready for it.
We watched it together.
We did watch it together.
Our movie this time is Interstellar by director Christopher Nolan. All right, so we watched this movie together. We'll see how well I remember it, but why don't you tell us what it was about?
Well, the Earth is on the verge of ecological collapse. There is a disease called the blight, and it's taking out all of the crops, and it's also somehow sucking all the oxygen out of the atmosphere. So people are going to suffocate and starve, and we've got to figure out some way of getting out there into space, which is made more convenient by the fact that a wormhole has been opened up just off the coast of Saturn.
The coast of Saturn.
I'm not sure how to refer
to that. Beachfront property.
Right. So by Saturn, there is this wormhole that has opened up that communicates with another galaxy. And so it's allowing us potentially to move the human population to planets on the other side of the wormhole. And so plan A and plan B. Plan A is that they're going to send a bunch of frozen embryos. Plan B is that they're going to figure out some way of manipulating gravity so that they can efficiently get the human population up off the surface of the Earth and transport a significant portion to this new planet, which will be either hospitable or which they will terraform or something like that.
So. It involves wormholes, black holes, time dilation, time travel. Mm-hmm. And also an idiot plot. But, you know, you can't have everything. So I thought we'd start with, I mean, what we liked.
Dreamy, dreamy Matthew McConaughey.
That's true. Right? All right.
Yeah, somebody had to do it. I'm glad it was you. All right.
I like seeing representations of black holes. I liked that they talked about time dilation. You know, there's two ways of having time dilation. One is, you know, your relativistic movement, just moving really fast, close to the speed of light. And the other way is being, you know, close to, you know, very deep gravity wells. So. There is, you know, gravitational time dilation even here on Earth.
Right.
You know, the core of the Earth experiencing a different time frame than we are up here.
Right.
It just is, you know, because...
And if you're in an airplane...
Slightly different. It's true, yeah. Imperceptibly so, but it is there. So I like that we had a show that did this and got people thinking about space and different planets and gravity in a different way.
Yeah. And the details of it, I'm not sure how accurate are, but the overall... general pattern, I think, is
the overall feel is good.
Yes,
the overall feel is good. So, first off, what is blight?
Yeah, this is like 30 seconds that is the premise for the whole movie, which is that Earth is uninhabitable.
I didn't understand where it, it's like, okay, they all described it as something that's killing the crops.
Yeah.
And it breathes nitrogen.
Yeah.
So it must be biological, like a disease or parasite, something. I guess we're to assume that it infects plants and kills them.
Right.
The only ones they ever talk about, though, are crop plants.
Right.
So, okay, so it's starving the humanity by destroying our crops.
But it's also, they say it's going to suffocate it because... by some mechanism that they don't really lay out, it is using nitrogen, but it's also destroying the oxygen in some way.
I don't know. Really understand that.
So the oxygen levels supposedly are going down. So maybe the thought is that it's destroying the plants. The plants make the oxygen, so you run out of the oxygen. But even so, how likely is it that you have some sort of blight that's going to affect all plants? That's going to affect the cyanobacteria. It's going to take all of those things out. And there's no resistance among anything to this. That resistance doesn't evolve. We can't somehow engineer plants or new things that are not susceptible to the blight. I mean, it seems like all of that is going to be easier.
That's easier than going to space.
Going to space and terraforming some new planet of marginal habitability.
And it's a biological thing. Who's to say it's not going to hitchhike on the spaceship?
Yeah.
If you can keep it off the spaceships, then you can keep it out of a greenhouse or a hydroponic facility.
Exactly.
That would be infinitely
easier,
more cost-effective and easier to do than let's go to space.
Let's find a new way to manipulate gravity so that we can lift people off the planet, shoot them through a wormhole to these marginally habitable planets, which we're then going to terraform.
Right.
So,
which apparently they give up on the terraforming thing because they were just hanging out in space by the end of the movie. I don't understand. I mean, there's no solving gravity anyways. Right. There's been no evidence.
Wait, Matt. They actually do solve gravity. That's how they get into the space.
Oh, right. Yeah, sure. I mean, that's just complete. I mean, it's a science fiction show anyways, but that is complete fiction.
There's so at the end...
No evidence that anything can do that.
So that at the end, they have figured out how to do this, and they have lifted the human population off the planet. We are now living in these giant space probes, cylindrical space probes. They seem very similar to something that Arthur C. Clarke described in Rendezvous with Rama. I don't know if you ever read that, mm-hmm. but they were these sort of interstellar probes that came in, and they had whole kind of cities living in the inside of them. So whole civilizations living in the inside of them.
I like the view of, the space station there. There was like just like a...
Where you look up and you see the other side.
Well, it's like Babylon 5, has the big spinning disc, and they're on the inside of the disc with their feet outward.
Yeah, so you're spinning the disc to create the gravity, and the people are living all around the inside.
Whatever. I don't know. So the entire premise of the movie, I don't buy at all. I think it's dumb.
Yeah.
So the rest of it, wormholes, of course, are stupid. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. Look, sci-fi nerds. Wormholes are a stupid necessity of sci-fi.
This is a constructed wormhole.
It doesn't matter. The concept of wormholes are a stupid, necessity.
Are they not taken seriously by people like Stephen Hawking as a theoretical possibility?
Oh, sure. Absolutely. In fact, the science consultant for this movie, Kip Thorne, 2017 winner of the Nobel Prize in Physics for his LIGO detector and gravitational wave contributions to that. But he was a science consultant for this movie. He's put a lot of thought into wormholes, different types of things, but they're just a mathematic possibility. You know, every solution to how we could have a wormhole usually ends up in, we need negative energy and exotic matter. Mm-hmm. What is negative energy? What is exotic matter? And exotic matter is defined as something that's not like any matter we have. So it's like, great. You know, I could do a lot of things if I had access to something that didn't exist.
We're inventing new kinds of matter all the time, right? New kinds of energy, new kinds of matter, dark matter, dark energy.
Ugh. Goodness.
So what's wrong with exotic matter? I kind of like that.
I don't know. I think wormholes are dumb. I get it. You need for any sort of sci-fi space spanning, story, you need some way of traversing the emptiness of space, the huge distances we're talking about. So warp drive, jump drive, wormholes, somewhere in there, someone's going to put them in there, but they don't have a basis in reality.
So it's the idea that they get to is that humans in the future, five-dimensional beings that transcend time and somehow, and they constructed this for us, but...
They constructed the wormhole, they constructed something inside the black hole.
And they constructed, yes, but they constructed to connect this wormhole, to connect us with this place that, as we discovered, does not have habitable planets around.
It seems to me that the entire reason they bridged... The five-dimensional beings were not trying to get humanity to any of those planets. The five-dimensional beings were trying to get Matthew McConaughey to fall in that black hole, because that's how he solved everything.
Okay.
So the planets had nothing to do with any... That's the only thing I can come up with. They did not plan for that at all. They did not care.
That is a bold, bold plan. I know how we're going to solve this problem. I'm going to throw Matthew McConaughey into a...
And how would they know that he would do that?
Yeah.
How do they know that anyone would be like, I'm going to hop in that thing?
They're
five-dimensional and somehow forgot about time or something.
Time is all a dimension to them. They can travel backwards and forwards through it, and they can plan things out.
I don't know. Well, let's talk about the other interesting bits. Is that?
Oh, wait. No, before we do that, we need to highlight the fact that they put the wormhole, even though it's for Matthew McConaughey, into the black hole, they put it next to Saturn. Now, why? If it's being constructed, why not put it in someplace that's convenient, right? Why not put it someplace close by, not someplace that takes you 2 years of, being in a sleep state?
Right? I think so, too. And also, kind of a jerk move on these five-dimensional humans, that after Matthew McConaughey does his mission and successfully saves humanity by, tweeting at his daughter in the past.
Yes.
The structure inside the black hole collapses, and he is spit out in space.
Just floating around.
They could have sent him back any time. They sent him back at the end of his daughter's life on her deathbed. Mm-hmm. Like,
Well,
they could have done like it was more 30 years ago.
It was more moving that way.
Like, man, geez. Yeah. So yeah, the whole time paradox of that thing bothers me too. Mm-hmm. It's like the only reason future humans are allowed to exist is that Matthew McConaughey fell in a black hole. But Matthew McConaughey only fell in the black hole because the future human sent him there with a wormhole.
Every time travel movie has the time paradox that's essentially unsolvable.
It's dumb.
You just have to accept it.
I do not have to accept it. I can wag my finger at it and say...
You're legally required to accept it.
I am not.
The Motion Picture Act of 1952.
That's right. This is another corollary to the Hague Protocol.
That's right.
Goodness. All right, well, a lot of people, when they talk about Interstellar, they want to talk about the black hole itself and time dilation, because that is the interesting bit of this, is that a lot of the story centers around the time dilation aspect of living next to this black hole, which, again, I contend is absolutely ancillary to the plot. But, you know, it's still there. When they get to what they're calling Miller's Planet, right? Mm-hmm. Miller's Planet is close enough to this black hole, close enough to this huge gravity well, that it experiences a 60,000 to 1 factor time dilation. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, 1 second on that planet or 1 hour on that planet is the equivalent of, you know, years and years outside. And so it's a huge difference there. And also the planet is like right next to the black hole. That's how it does it. So my question is, how close to a black hole would a planet have to be to get that level of time dilation? How big would the black hole have to be? And could a planet survive that close to a black hole?
And would it plausibly have an ecology that could support human beings?
Right.
Yes.
Yeah. So that's the issue here. So do black holes emit light? Mm-hmm. Well, not necessarily, but black holes often have what's called an accretion disk around them that is full of very hot stuff. And yes, these can be hot enough to emit light. Unfortunately, black holes, their accretion disks emit ultraviolets and x-rays. So not visible light, you are cooked. You are cooked in literally and in the Gen Z way, you are cooked.
Yeah, which wouldn't necessarily be a problem under the water, but for human beings who don't want to live down there with the glowy fish.
To be that close to this black hole, you would also have to be within the accretion disk, which would, again, obliterate the planet.
Yeah.
There's a lot of highly convenient factors about this thing. And so the science consultant, again, Kip Thorne, who, you know, dreamt up a lot of this, or also dreamt up explanations to how it could possibly go the way Christopher Nolan decided to have picked it, rely on a whole bunch of, well, if it's exactly that, if the black, so like if this was a supermassive black hole, like literally the size of the one at the center of the Milky Way galaxy, like that size, and also spinning almost as fast as nature could possibly allow it to, and also if it never had an accretion disk, this could happen.
But if it didn't have an accretion disk, then it wouldn't be producing light. And so what's the energy source for things on the planet?
Go figure. I don't think this could happen.
Maybe geothermal energy? Maybe you could use geothermal energy. But when they go to the planet, there's light there.
If it is on the planet, I mean, one side of the planet's going to be closer to the black hole than the other one. There's going to be huge, like, gravitational tidal forces that maybe, could lead to a warming effect. On the spaceship side of things, I take issue with...
This is about docking procedures.
About docking procedures. They had some very tense docking procedures.
And this is when they've gone on to Matt Damon's planet, and they are coming back, and they're racing Matt Damon back, because Matt Damon is a villain in this story. And Matt Damon ends up exploding. Right? Matt Damon explodes.
He does explode. Poor guy.
All right, sir. My condolences to all of the Matt Damon fans out there. He explodes in this movie. Right? And he sends the spaceship rotating. Right? Speeds it up so that it's spinning at a really, really high rate. And then Matthew McConaughey, Cooper, is trying to get back to the space station. He has to dock with this rapidly rotating
Which really
ship.
Bothers me. It's like, okay, like, yes, the one rotating around the perimeter of this of the Endurance, that's the space station. You can't dock it anymore because now it's spinning around.
Right.
But there is another one at the very bottom of it, along like the axis of the hub. Yeah.
The hub.
And that one is... miraculously spinning exactly along its axis. What are the chances that Matt Damon's ship blows off the airlock and sends it spinning perfectly aligned along that? Because if it was even a little bit of wobble, There's no way you're docking with that. Mm-hmm. That's just absurd. Yeah. Absolutely absurd. And also, do you know what the term delta V means?
Uh-huh. Change in velocity.
Change in velocity. This is a rocketry term. You know, the amount of delta V your spaceship has is how much it can change its velocity. Mm-hmm. It's depending on the engines themselves, how much fuel you're carrying, your mass, and whatever like that. At the beginning of the film, it takes a giant two-stage rocket to launch the shuttle from Earth to orbit. Later on, that same shuttle is going up and down multiple times from other planets of its own power. Mm-hmm. One of them being the water planet, which is described as having twice the gravity mm-hmm. of Earth. Mm-hmm. So, wow, that's some great fuel. Mm-hmm. Why did they waste that V2 rocket on it, or whatever size mm-hmm. rocket that was at the beginning, yeah. when it could apparently just fly right up, no problems? The last bit I have is, look, kids, there's nothing inside black holes. That's it. Okay, there's no evidence that there's a magical realm inside the black hole.
No one's ever been there.
I mean,
so
that's true.
You can't positively say
and yet,
that there
we
are
kind
no
of know what they're made
and...
from. Mm-hmm. We kind of know how they form. We kind of know what's going on there.
We think we know a lot, but we're not so smart.
Not until we send Matthew McConaughey into one.
That's right.
But that's what I got for Interstellar.
Yeah, I have to say, as a human drama, it is an incredibly compelling story, and you're with it the whole way. If you're pausing the movie to argue about the science, it's a little less enjoying.
That's true.
Wait, what are they talking about? It's 30 seconds. The whole movie hinges on this 30 seconds. It doesn't make any sense.
Doesn't make any sense, yeah. No.
All right.
But it was overall an enjoyable movie, and I'm glad we watched it.
Excellent. All right. So that is it for Yakety Science Ruins the Movie. Hopefully your joy was crushed under the heel of our boots.
And asphixiated like those humans were about to be.
Yes.
Yeah.
And the victims of Fritz Haber.
Oh, goodness, them too.
Before we go, we need to take care of the sound science puzzler from the top of the show. Your hint was that it is a sound from springtime in Tulsa. And here it is again, in case you've forgotten. That's it. That's the sound, and it is actually the sound of Froggy Gonocortin, because that is the chorusing of chorus frogs. They are out. They are calling. They are responding to the warmth and the moisture. So go out and listen to the symphony of nature all around you.
I like it. I did think frogs when I heard it. Yes. Yeah. It was a frog choir, you said. A bufo choir.
That's right. Excellent. Yes, you were learning so much from your time spent with me, Matt. All right.
As always, we leave you with a wise, wise quote from a sciencey person of note. This week, we hear from Carl Sagan, who reminds us that the Earth is the only world known so far to harbor life. There is nowhere else, at least in the near future, to which our species could migrate. Visit? Yes. Settle? Not yet. Like it or not, for the moment, the Earth is where we make our stand. That's from A Pale Blue Dot. And with those humbling words, we leave you, dear listeners, until the next episode of Yakety Science.
Thanks for listening.
Take care.
Yakety Science is produced, written, and edited by Matt Smith and Brian Cross. Production help provided by Scott Gregory. Theme music by Lobo Loco. Yakety Science is recorded at the studios of Public Radio Tulsa and at the Center for Creativity at Tulsa Community College. If you'd like to yak back at us, our email is yaketyscience@gmail.com. We love to hear from you.
All right, all right, all right.